Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of English, the American and New England Studies Program, and the African American Studies Program titled Dear Sister, Phyllis Wheatley's Pleasures. Our speaker is Tara Bynum, Assistant Professor of English and African American Studies at Hampshire College. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of English, Joseph Rezik.
Professor Bynum is really extraordinary. She's writing work on Phyllis Wheatley now that everyone in the field that I know is reading, and that you can't say that about a lot of scholars in any field. She's now an assistant professor of African American literature and culture at Hampshire College. Before joining Hampshire College, she held professorial or postdoctoral positions at Towson University, Rutgers University, and the College of Charleston. Her work has been awarded fellowships from numerous organizations, including the National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Antiquarian Society, the Library Company of Philadelphia, and the McNeil Center for Early American Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her essays have appeared in Commonplace, Legacy, J19, Criticism, and American Periodicals. She is currently working on a very highly anticipated book project, Reading Pleasures, which examines the ways in which 18th century enslaved and or free men and women feel good or experience pleasure in spite of the privations of slavery, unfreedom, or white supremacy. I first met Professor Bynum in Philadelphia at the McNeil Center many years ago, and I have been following her published work somewhat at a distance since then. As I've said, her recent brilliant essays on Phyllis Wheatley's everyday life and pleasures have made an immediate impact on the fields of Wheatley studies, early American studies, and early African American studies. Colleagues across the country are teaching these essays, citing them and responding to them in print. Bynum has led the way in moving a discussion of Wheatley away from her 1773 printed book of poems towards her manuscript letters and their powerful reflection of what mattered in her life to herself and to her close friends and associates. This work complicates the image of Wheatley as a poet responding only either to her enslaved status or to late 18th century religious or political ideologies. Tara and I have recently become reacquainted through our work on a forthcoming Cambridge University Press volume, African American Literature in Transition, edited by Rhonda Thomas. But it was on the basis of these essays that I invited her to speak here at BU. I expect we'll hear more about all of this today. Her talk is entitled Dear Sister, Phyllis Wheatley's Pleasures. Please join me in welcoming her.
I sometimes wish I had a list of Phyllis Wheatley's pleasures. I never imagine it to be a long list, but it's always an obvious list, though. It's in her handwriting, and at the top it reads something really plain and clear, like Phyllis Wheatley's list of pleasures. I imagine that she lists material objects and abstract desires, for example, publication of her second volume of poetry, or Freedom for All Enslaved Women and Men, or maybe a mention of her new pocketbook and quill pen set. I do notice that she's got a spiteful sensibility on this list and includes very public acts of resistance. And what's clear is just how much she delights in each item on this imagined list. Now, admittedly, I don't suspect this list exists, and quite frankly, I only want it for selfish reasons, namely to avoid the looks of confusion when I mention my longstanding interest in pleasure, quotidian living, and 18th century subjectivity. At this point, after doing this research for long enough and talking to folks for long enough, I know to expect the quizzical looks and the questions that wonder just how pleasure is in fact possible in the lives of 18th century African Americans. I've learned that when we think about poet Phyllis Wheatley as the first Black person to publish a book of poetry, her story is as simple as the language of the frontispiece. We know to whom she belongs, we know where she lives, we know that maybe she demands freedom from slavery because she says so in a letter. She hints at the accessibility of heaven to all people, even white Christians and Negroes black as Cain, and on being brought from Africa to America. We don't seem to know, though, that Wheatley knows pleasures because she is a person and because she has an interiority, or what Toni Morrison refers to as, quote, that private place where we lived and where we exercised skill and power, be it over biscuit dough or quilts, railroads or levees, architecture or baskets, end quote. This interiority makes her human, a real person. And it's the sight, it's the sight of this feeling good that helps make Wheatley's life worthy of living. Now, what exactly is pleasure as I am using it? It's certainly a fraught term. I mean it as James Baldwin speaks of it. James Baldwin tells me pleasure is the feeling that you get when you respect and rejoice in the force of life itself, and to be present in all that one does, from the effort of loving to the breaking of bread. Wheatley experiences what I call pleasure, joy, happiness, or quite simply feeling good often, and speaks of it quite a bit in her poems and letters. Pleasures, of course, live in the body. They are felt inwardly and in the somewhere that scholars have called interiority, as I've mentioned before. It's there deep down inside where we feel those pleasures, big or small, that help make life livable amidst the unspeakable. So even in the 18th century, and even for the early African-American writers that I study more generally, pleasure happens often enough to be recorded. I mean, I'm not going to do that here, but we could definitely talk about John Maron if we needed to. We could talk about David Walker. We could talk about James Albert Ukasaw Graniosa. We can even talk about the decidedly and emotionally lukewarm Venture Smith, I would argue. And yet it's never often the case that scholars in particular speak of Black folks' pleasures. But what's certain is that pleasure is, in fact, available to Black people, well, because they say so. I've learned that pleasure is often a scary word for my interlocutors, those in particular who doubt that pleasure in enslaved Black women is, in fact, a thing. Pleasure lacks severity and solemnity. It seems to trivialize the trauma that is meant to validate just how much Black lives matter. Pleasure can do what suffering and trauma cannot. It can make real what matters most to Wheatley and, of course, those others that I've mentioned. I know neither history nor its archival libraries make it so easy to find evidence of those good feelings, but pleasure is there if we are willing to read it and read for it. So I'm about to tell a two-part story with Uber Tanner and Phyllis Wheatley at its center. Part one is a story that begins with an ending, the last bit of correspondence between two teenagers and then women, enslaved and eventually freed. Wheatley's letters to Tanner, only a handful of them, from 1772 to 1779 are extant, are decidedly ordinary glimpses into a friendship between women. Amidst the growing conflict between the colonies in England and Wheatley's emerging stardom, Wheatley and Tanner chronicle their movements as young women and then 20-somethings until Wheatley's death at about 31. Wheatley's letters greet Tanner with familiarity. Dear sister is one of the most common salutations, and her choice of hello names who they are and what they mean to one another, sisters in God and friends. Her other extant letters refuse this familiarity. To everyone else, she is consistently a humble servant who greets her addressee, whether it's John Thornton, Selina Hastings, Madam Worcester, among others, with the requisite formality. Because the whereabouts of Tanner's letters to Wheatley are unknown, it's Wheatley's letters that tell their stories of belonging, friendship, and love. Wheatley collects and remembers Tanner's words with passing references to what she's mentioned in earlier letters. For example, Tanner's repeated prayers for Wheatley's well-being, her biblical references that minister to Wheatley, and her faithful and fulfilling relationship with God. When Wheatley writes to Tanner, she is more than a humble servant. She is more often an affectionate friend, or most affectionately hers, or a sincere friend, or dear sister. Her formality in those other letters gives way to the familiarity and the kind of affection that comes from their shared intimacy. Even her postscripts to Tanner, occasioned by the receipt of a shipment of 300 books or a chance meeting with a clever and agreeable man, suggest familiarity and the secret keeping of close friends. And their letters matter because their friendships, their letters matter not only to each other, because that's obvious, but to me, because their friendship invites us and requires us to consider the very possibility of pleasures in the lives of Black girls and women in and around 18th century New England. So as Wheatley seeks to know and speak with Tanner, their intimacy centers both Wheatley and Tanner at the site of a belonging where their expression of love and affection from one woman to another is a necessary and even critical practice. This intimacy allows both women to privilege who they are individually and together. By way of her letters to Tanner, Wheatley's story turns toward a friendship that cares for that which matters most to her and Tanner. And I suspect those are God, family, nation, and friendship. But now part two, or the second part of this story, is an ending with a bit of uncertainty. I still can't answer those questions about which my students and my historian friends and some of my literature friends wonder. I don't know where Tanner's letters to Wheatley are, even though I'm hoping to find a box one day soon. I think I'll find it. It'll be in a nice box that says Uber Tanner's letters to Phyllis Wheatley. I don't know how Wheatley and Tanner meet. I don't have any answers yet about how Tanner winds up in Worcester or how Wheatley finds out about it. I don't know if Tanner cries when she hears the news of Wheatley's passing. What I do know is that in their 7 years of extant correspondence, they worship together and delight with each other on the page. Their friendship gestures towards what friend means. Friend suggests intimacy, conveys love, and shares its root meaning with freedom. Wheatley's letters plot an intimacy that speaks love and grants a kind of freedom to share, to feel, to conspire. And each creates a woman freedom that bespeaks the ways of saying things, and those things they say admit to their mutual intimacy. Tanner acts as an interlocutor capable of understanding Wheatley. And Tanner and Wheatley, of course, know each other well. And this knowing makes for the happiness that imbues this kind of friendship, which comes from the simple belief and understanding that what one is feeling and doing is right. Both women believe their friendship, their love, and their collective faith in God is right and worthy of sharing. And so their letters begin quite simply with, "Dear sister." So I'm going to read this aloud, but this is the letter that I'll be paying my closest attention to today. I don't normally do this, but I'm going to start at the end. The last extant letter, and that is this right here. It seems fitting that Phyllis Wheatley's last extant letter, dated the 10th of May, 1779, is to Uber Tanner. It, like every letter before it, also begs a return to this particular friendship and correspondence. She wants to return to the pleasures of writing, to and receiving a note from her friend. It reads, "Dear Uber, by this opportunity, I have the pleasure to inform you that I am well and hope you are so. Though I've been silent, I have not been unmindful of you, but a variety of hindrances was the cause of my not writing to you. But in time to come, I hope our correspondence will revive and revive in better times. Pray write me soon, for I long to hear from you. You may depend on constant replies. I wish you much happiness and am, dear Uber, your friend and sister, Phyllis Peters." No letter to Tanner immediately precedes this one, and no letter to anyone follows. Here is the limit of Phyllis Wheatley's epistolary archive. The letter finds Tanner in Worcester and Wheatley, now married to John Peters in Boston. Phyllis and John Peters, a shopkeeper and a free black man, live together on Queen Street. It's Cumberland who carries her brief note to Tanner. She doesn't say how she knows where Tanner is, since it's been some years since they last spoke, at least in letters. This isn't the letter that includes any mention of her recent marriage to Peters or any reference to the second volume of poetry that she hopes to publish in the upcoming months. Wheatley reminds Tanner that she hasn't spoken to her friend in a while. She doesn't say how long. Wheatley only writes with her sense of urgency to hear again from her friend and her longing to speak and to revive their past dialogues. Wheatley's urgency seeks after a language which expresses her grasp of reality as present and immediate. Wheatley grasps not only for fitting language, but also for a friend, because even in love, such urgency must not be suspended. Wheatley admits to her part in the silence. She says, "Though I have been silent, I've not been unmindful of you." She doesn't concern herself with those hindrances that have prompted her lack of correspondence or her lack of response to Tanner's inquiries. It only confesses that she's well. She seems to resist excuses. Urgency compels Wheatley to revive or return to life her correspondence with Tanner. And her choice to revive, to use the word revive, clamors for the discursive intimacy and mutual exchange that she seeks. When her words fail, dashes intercede. What's not clear in the printed edition is their varied length in manuscript form. Wheatley's breaks are not consistent. Some are decidedly short, while others linger. She seems to interrupt herself, to hold or catch her breath with a brief or lengthy pause that offers no word-based explanation. Rather, her short and long dashes reach toward what she cannot say aloud or what she must rush past. When she doesn't specify the hindrances that keep her away, a dash of moderate length replaces her possible excuses. With every short or lengthy dash of apostrophe, Wheatley mimes the process of death and resurrection. Words meet pauses, then return to words again. Her words return her from the dead. The frequent movement from word to pause to word marks a restoration of feeling, a return to the pleasure she feels when speaking to her friend. She recollects her capacity for feeling with Tanner. Wheatley's revival of their correspondence asks to return to the profound, deep sharing, the erotic that marks their earlier letters. Despite the silences, dashes, and apostrophe, Wheatley articulates her desire to feel deeply with Tanner again and to return to the pleasure of their conversation. She seeks the shared language that allows her to delight in a varied kind of worship with her friend. She seeks to restore what she has missed, the eroticism of a friendship that allows life to feel itself out and to share what it knows. By eroticism, I don't mean to suggest that which is explicitly sexual. I do mean to invoke Audre Lorde's usage of the term. Lorde describes the erotic as a resource, a power which arises from our deepest and non-rational knowledge, an internal sense of satisfaction to which, once we have experienced it, we know we can aspire, and quite simply, the sharing of deep feeling with another. I find the erotic useful because it bears witness to the pursuit, those intimate and corporeal experiences that seek after desire and its satisfaction. And ultimately, the satisfaction of a desire, I would argue, is a pleasure. Lorde recognizes the many ways in which the erotic operates, a way of profound knowing and affectively driven creativity, a quotidian and sensory experience, a capacity for joy that is ultimately not selfish. It's a kind of erotic that Wheatley hints at with every letter, and certainly even more with her invocation of, now I said dear, but I'm just going to say dr at the start of the letter. This final letter's chosen term of endearment. Wheatley starts her letter with dr, the uber, because she ends with it too, just before she reminds Tanner that she's still her friend and sister. I suspect that the DR abbreviates her favorite and most common salutation, dear. That's one option. Nearly every other letter to Tanner begins with dear. There's the dear sister, the dear Uber, I think there's a dear friend. Yet it's still true that DR also serves as a shortened form of doctor. And if we hear her elision correctly, dear and doctor name just what Wheatley seeks, a friend and a healer. It is this return to friendship that she hopes will heal her. What kind of healing is uncertain? Illness plagues Wheatley frequently, for sure, but there are other forms of healing that Tanner may be able to help her with, too. In this letter, Wheatley says that she is well, and her choice of abbreviation here seems to appeal for an additional support, the kind that comes from a good or best friend. She knows it can because it has done so before. In earlier letters, with every mention of grief or illness, Wheatley invites and allows Tanner to pray over her. Let's remember Wheatley's mention of her recovery in July 19th, 1772 letter. She writes, "Let me be interested in your prayers that God would please to bless to me the means used for my recovery, if agreeable to his holy will." Surely Wheatley is interested in Tanner's prayers because Tanner's prayers seem to work. When Tanner prays for Wheatley, Wheatley is consistently blessed with a recovery. In a later letter, she thanks Tanner for her good advices and her tenderness for her welfare. 7 years later, Wheatley hopes for and believes again that she will receive a remedy if Tanner prays for her. Tanner's healing abilities are at present unknown, but even her name, I say Uber, and I haven't been able to ask her how she pronounces it. So to me, might sound something like Obi or Obia intimates the kind of healing for which Wheatley so desperately seeks. And with this testimony of pleasure and this declaration of longing to revive what is past, Wheatley's final letter to Tanner speaks of the deep down pleasure that she must have shared together with Tanner. It's a letter that remembers that theirs is an ordinary friendship. It is neither unique nor is it extraordinary. Of course, because Wheatley knows who Tanner is to her, she never bothers to write answers to those questions that I ask whenever I read these letters. None of her letters ever gives up too much of what she knows about Tanner. She doesn't mention how they meet or why Reverend Hopkins or his son sometimes conveys their correspondence. She doesn't tell me who Mr. Pemberton is or why she sees Zingo Stevens walking down the street in Providence. She doesn't write of the last time she sees Tanner or under what circumstances. Now, there's no letter that answers these questions and no letter that neatly closes the story between these two women. And with no response or subsequent letter, there's no way to learn what happens next. But what we do have, what these letters tell us for sure, is that they have written of faith, exchanged money, shared advice, and learned to be friends with one another. This last letter precedes Wheatley's death by 5 years. So by 1784, Phyllis Wheatley has passed on. Her second book is never published, though a few of her poems appear in periodicals here and there. The announcement of Wheatley's death remembers her as a celebrated poet. Nevertheless, she dies without much money, and her husband, who's a very, what's the right word, like complicated, kind of consistently trashed figure in the history of Wheatley. So I'm going to say he may have sold off all of her remaining wares to pay off debts. I'm not sure. Maybe he was a good man. History doesn't seem to think so, but I don't know precisely why. And Honoré Jeffers has in a recent article put forth the idea that maybe John wasn't that bad. Maybe life was just hard, you know. Uber Tanner outlives Wheatley by about 50 years. She leaves behind her name in the census, on a baptismal registry, and a record of marriage to Barry Collins, and correspondent as president of the Female Society in Newport, Rhode Island. She also appears, again, albeit briefly, in two separate provenances for a small batch of Wheatley letters in 1863 and for a recent auction of Valentine's Day 1776 letter between Tanner and Wheatley. Both the provenances tell us that Tanner gives Wheatley's letters to Miss William Beecher of Northfield, her name's Catherine, a daughter-in-law of Lyman Beecher and sister-in-law to Harriet Beecher Stowe. William and Catherine lived in Newport for a short while, and while Catherine is in Newport, she meets Tanner. She describes her even as, quote, very little, very old, very infirmed, very, very black woman with a great shock of the whitest wool all over her head. Catherine goes on to say that Tanner died in the odor of sanctity sometime in 1833 or 1834, an uncommonly pious, sensible, and intelligent woman, respected and visited by every person in Newport who could appreciate excellence, unquote. Tanner may have given the letters to Catherine Beecher in 1833 or 1834, just before Tanner dies in 1835. The provenance not only reveals Tanner's continued participation in and around Newport's religious and Congregationalist communities, and her relationship with Beecher in particular, it also evidences Tanner's desire to keep and to hold her friend close. Even though Tanner's words don't survive, Wheatley's do, because Tanner keeps her so close to protect her words and her memory. She passes her letters and a book of poetry on to Catherine for unspecified reasons, but I suspect she gives them away to a woman that she knows will care for them too. Beecher eventually hands off the letters to Edward Hale, who helps secure a place for them at the Massachusetts Historical Society. What's left of these women as friends together is only this final letter, favored by Cumberland, that hopes and prays for a response. What Wheatley seeks reminds us that women must seek to become their own historical subject in pursuit of its proper object, its proper and specific expression in time. These letters make subjects of Wheatley and Tanner in pursuit of various objects of their desire, love, fellowship, friendship, and God. The letters record the salvation, love, and friendship wherein both women feel and delight in the pleasures of a freedom in each other and God. And their shared faith acts as a kind of orientation, a basic turning of the soul toward another reality where worship and friendship happen in letters between friends. And religion allows both women to mash out a meaning of life because their form of worship conspires to realize where two or three are gathered, so is God. Wheatley and Tanner together acknowledge the everyday materiality of life and narrate a shared way of being that bears witness to the intimacy, love, and freedom that makes living worthwhile and confesses to the good feeling that makes their intimacy, their love, and freedom so real. Each letter offers the mundane as the beginning of a mutual prayer for the continued blessings and godly mercies on their lives. And together they worship God and live a friendship wherein the promise of God's love authors the intimacy that inspires the epistolary space of mutual language and exchange. Wheatley posits a way into a possibility as she also invites a reading of friendship that imagines what makes these women so compellingly human. They love each other as they love God. Wheatley and Tanner, through a collective letter-based faith and worship, experience God, and as a consequence, journey inward together in order to experience the pleasures of an abiding friendship in God. Even though their letters can't tell us if their next meeting happens on earth or elsewhere, it aspires toward a final certainty that together they will meet again. Thank you.
So, questions?
So, I know that, a lot of your work is getting us to, like, shift our attention away from her poems and into this other body of work that she's left behind that hasn't been studied enough. But I do wonder, like, if the letters and your category of pleasure, like, change the way you read her poems at all, or, like, if the letters have, like, something to say to those poems, or is that work just kind of not quotidian enough that they're kind of in separate spheres, or just, I kind of was wondering what you think about that.
So my work with Wheatley started with her poems, and it shifted to the letters. So because it's really the poems that get me to think about pleasure. There's a moment in Thoughts on the Works of Providence that I couldn't quite make sense of. So she says, where fancy's queen and giddy triumph reigns, here in soft strains the dreaming lover sigh to a kind fair or a raven jealousy. On pleasure now and now on vengeance bent, the laboring passion struggle for a vent. And I remember getting to that. I think I was in graduate school. I was like, wait, Phyllis Wheatley has a dreaming lover? Who is her dreaming lover? What is she talking about? There's another moment as well. In On Imagination, that seems, and because I'm looking for it, of course, it's not immediately apparent, but she certainly talks about these subject passions again. And there's Aurora in Tithon's bed. Yes, from Tithon's bed now might Aurora rise, her cheeks all glowing with celestial dyes. Like, what's Aurora doing in Tithon's bed? Why are her cheeks flushed? What is that? So these are the moments that get me wondering, like, wait, if here I've been assuming that because Phyllis Wheatley is enslaved, she is so burdened by the labor of enslavement, she is incapable of any other kind of feeling other than suffering. So that's my assumption. And then I get to reading the poems closely, and suddenly there's language that's like, she might be suffering, but not all the time. She certainly has a curiosity about another set of feelings. So if she has a curiosity about it, why shouldn't I assume that she has felt or will feel these feelings, acknowledging the fact that, you know, she's young when she's writing them. So maybe it's fantasy, but she is capable of fantasizing in this way. So I'm not opposed to the poems. And in fact, I would love for people to think about her poems pleasurably, But the letters became more striking to me because nobody talks about the letters, really. So there was just a gap. I mean, there are books and books and books about Phyllis Wheatley's poems. But let me know if you know a book that's about Phyllis Wheatley's letters. That'd be helpful to me. Well, and you shouldn't, because it doesn't exist.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for your presentation, Professor Bynum. Forgive the baggy nature of this question, but you've got me thinking about quite a few things.
Okay.
I'll start off with a little story. When I think about the dialectic of black pleasure and black trauma or black suffering, I think about that moment when Zora Neale Hurston begins her, which piece is it, where she's critiquing, she's essentially critiquing Du Bois's The Sorrow Songs.
Okay.
I think it's neo-spirituals, yeah? When Du Bois describes The Sorrow Songs as the voice of black suffering, the voice of exile, and then Zora Neale Hurston, she looks and she says, well, that's not what I heard. She heard joy. She heard energy. She heard passion. She heard ecstasy, right? And I think about that when I think about our new turn in, for example, black queer studies and black discourses around issues of pleasure as a subversive power, which is what you're working with. And I'm curious about what you think the larger stakes of this turn to black pleasure may be, because you began by alluding to these sort of quizzical faces who respond to your your take on black pleasure. I'm wondering, who were those faces? Were they black? Were they white? Or who is invested most deeply in the narrative of black suffering as the defining narrative of African-American experience? For example, when Zora Neale Hurston was critiquing Du Bois, she was critiquing a black hyper-investment in trauma. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's what's going on now, or do you see yourself involved in that conversation?
So I do see myself involved in a conversation that wants to admit a profound disinterest in suffering. Suffering to me is really easy. And I think it's easy because it's quantifiable. You know, suffering can be easily numbered, whether we're talking about the number of lynched bodies, the number of people killed by police officers, like whether we're looking at slave ship roles, like it's very quantifiable. Pleasure is harder to catch. I mean, it can be a fleeting feeling. It can also be a feeling that's generated entirely inwardly. So you might not know why you're amused, but you just, you know, like, oh, I woke up feeling good today. That's a plus, you know. I think, though, in thinking about who doubts that pleasure is possible, I almost think that it's everybody. So if I'm in my classroom with the range of students that are in there from a variety of backgrounds, and at this point I feel like I've taught up and down the East Coast, so whether it's East Coast South, East Coast North, the idea of black pleasure in particular in academic space is just foreign. Like, how could it be the case that black people are that black people feel pleasure? It's funny, I have to show this because I think that'd be there. This is from a Phyllis Wheatley letter to John Thornton. So I'm at some kind of academic reception, and I say what my project is. You know, I'm talking about pleasure in 18th century African American literature, and of course I know to anticipate the like, really? What kind of pleasure? Well, the pleasure that feels good. What do you mean by feeling good? Like, I literally mean good feeling. So this is the nature of the conversation. And I say to the person that I'm talking to, like, Phyllis Wheatley tells jokes. And the said person looks back at me like, do you think she's feeling anxious? And I thought about it, and I was like, well, I don't, maybe, but you can be anxious and tell a joke, right? You know, like, that's the half the time I think anxious people tell jokes so they can feel less anxious. So John Thornton has invited Phyllis Wheatley to go on a mission trip to West Africa. And she is kind of like, no, I'm not going. I don't want to go. I can't speak the language. And then she says, upon my arrival, how like a barbarian I should look to the natives. I can promise that my tongue shall be quiet. She, you know, kind of speaks about why it would be foolish. And then she says, now to be serious. So you know, maybe it's just the lit close reader in me, but if you say now to be serious, what came before is not serious. That would be a joke, you know. But this is something that also has not been acknowledged. Like, there's a humor that exists in Phyllis Wheatley's letters as well. And that humor may be evident in her poems. So another way to think about On Being Brought from Africa to America might be to acknowledge the possibility of humor, or, you know, and maybe a humor that's not even satire, but like, I'm telling a joke because that's what I know how to do. So I think that this is a long answer, but I think that ultimately one of my aims in having us think about pleasure is really to make Black people multidimensional. I mean, I think in higher ed, so often Black is pathologized. And I think that pathologization, you know, ends up like mobilizing the discourse around Black people. It's what people write their books about. It's what people get tenure on. It's what, you know, I think it's what is most salient in many respects. And I think it does its work. But I also think that if we are going to take seriously the fact that Black people are cultural producers, which is what I believe, I think we should also take seriously the fact that, you know, Black people experience a wide range of emotions. They experience pain, they know pleasure, and they know all of the many emotions in between that pain and pleasure binary.
One of the things that I think was interesting is that Phyllis Wheatley came to Boston in the midst of a large wave of people that came after the end of the Seven Years' War. About three quarters of them probably came from Senegambia like she did, which is to say that there was certainly in Boston a large number of Mandinka speakers and Fulbe speakers and so on. So that, I mean, her tongue being quiet might not have been so much of a joke. She was probably bilingual, and she had plenty of opportunity to interact with other people in Boston. So I know those facts from reading statistical data, but I didn't actually know about the existence of this body of letters. But when I look at it now, I'm wondering, I mean, one of the questions I asked was that population would have been probably, the Afro-Boston population was probably more than 50% Muslim. Hmm. And this is at the same time when the Great Awakening is sort of crashing over the area. And of course, she's been caught up on the Christian side. West African Muslims were not, except there were actually some who were, we would consider jihadis today, but the majority of them were actually sort of prepared to deal with any Abrahamic religion. So I haven't really looked at Phyllis Wheatley. I'm too much of a historian, but I was actually, while you were talking, online, reading the letters at the Massachusetts Historical Society, Wonders of the Internet.
Right.
And I wonder if you have anything to offer on that. I can't help it. I'm John Thorne, so I got
to... So... you know, close readings, I don't think, play nice with public talks. But what I've had to do when thinking about, like, religion in the letters is go almost line by line to note her biblical references. So I don't know much about, and this is what I imagine historians are helpful to me for, is that context that you offered. Especially since I'm decidedly formalist in my sensibilities about literary text. But I think if I'm understanding your question to have me think about the religious sensibilities of Wheatley's letters, it is, in the letters to Tanner, it surprised me how deeply entrenched the biblical references are, especially since there are no citations, of course. Like, I would need the citations. Wheatley doesn't offer them, you know. How dare she not think about me? but I think that there's a, at least in my reading of the letters, I think I do take seriously the way that her Christian faith works and what her Christian faith is able to do for her, and the way that she seems to use the Bible in like framing their shared experience is really interesting to me, because it does offer her a language to, like, maybe interpret circumstance. There's certainly, I think what came up in class today and what has come up in my own classes is this possibility of coded language. I know Alexis Gums and I talked about the nature of the coded language that might be embedded in the letters. I'm a little less interested in the possibility of coding and more interested in taking seriously the fact of her faith and what happens when we accept her faith as something that she is a firm believer in, her Christian faith. But yeah, I think it's interesting to note how much Christianity and what I understand to be a worship experience is important to the letters. Like, it's like if you have your Bible alongside, it's like a church service. You know, I think that they are engaged in like sermon writing, and it makes me all the more sad to not have Tanner's letters.
I'm going to go back to the larger Black pleasure politics question. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you think of this. In some ways, the resistance to seeing Black pleasure and joy as either political or even existing could be due to the process by which slavery colonized Black joy in the sense of having represented Black people as endlessly joyful, always happy, happy to be slaves, mm-hmm. happy to be controlled. And I'm wondering if the fear of that stereotype has motivated a lot of us to sort of avoid it, in the same way that sexuality has been something that we have policed ourselves mm-hmm. due to, particularly with Black women, due to the overwhelming stereotypes of Black women as being so so sexual that therefore claiming sex or the erotic mm-hmm. becomes troubling. Right? And I'm wondering if there's a similar thing going on with the fear of Black joy.
I would think so. And I think as well that I think the fear of it, though, and this is part of my critique, is that it seems to center the white gaze. And what I am interested in doing is like putting, I mean, for the purposes of this talk, putting these two Black women at the center. So one of the things that I'm kind of fascinated by and haven't necessarily done enough with is there's a letter, another letter that is Valentine's Day, 1776. And we know what happened in 1776. Even my ahistorical sensibilities knows what happened in 1776. So in the months preceding the Declaration of Independence, Phyllis Wheatley is writing to Tanner to talk about what's happening in their area, in their region. And it was a moment where I had to realize, when I think about the American Revolution, I'm not thinking about Black women. I don't know where I had decided to put Black women, but they're not my go-tos. You know, like, oh, of course. I think that for me, putting Black pleasure at the center and not necessarily worrying about the happy slave stereotype, because it doesn't make any sense. But what does make sense is that human beings are capable of enduring horrible circumstances and being pleased within themselves and within their communities at one and the same time. And what happens when we shift the focus to what is happening within this particular Black community? I mean, is Phyllis Wheatley limited to the Black community between that she creates with Tanner? Not at all, but it's still a community nonetheless. So what happens when we imagine for a moment Phyllis Wheatley writing to Tanner and thinking about what she wants to say to Tanner? I think that opens up a ton of possibilities. And when you begin to look at all of the people that they know mutually that are referenced in the letters, suddenly there's a whole network of Black people that they interact with on a consistent and regular basis. So suddenly a community emerges that may not have to worry all the time about an imagined or real white gaze or white power structure.
May I ask a question about the close reading of the letter, the last letter between?
Sure.
There was a phrase that caught my attention, the phrase, "I have not been unmindful of you."
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious about the double negative there and the and what the word mindful meant at that time. So I'm interested in the meaning of that word, the historical meaning of the word. And so was she saying, "Oh, I haven't been ignoring you," or was she saying, "Gosh, I've been thinking about you"? I was just curious about that phrase.
You know, I have not looked up unmindful. The way that I've understood it is that I've been thinking of you. I guess I'm curious about the distinction that you're making between "I'm not ignoring you" and "I've been thinking of you," and how you hear that as different.
My question about the letter, too, at the end, is you can depend on my constant replies. I mean, it's just so weirdly tragic in an archival sense because there's no more after that, you know? So it's sort of like a, it's almost a perfectly tragic final letter because it promises a voluminous correspondence, but it can't deliver. And going on that, I just wonder if you can reflect on the archival challenges you've had. I mean, not merely just not having the letters, but reading in our class, we've been talking a little bit about the archive and its challenges and reading against the grain of the archive or finding or print as a compromised medium because of surveillance and censorship. So I wonder if you can reflect on your experience in the archive at various archives you've done research in and finding these letters and what it means to interact with the handwriting and just the kind of more material culture aspect of some of these relationships you're finding.
So I've thought a lot about the archive because when it comes to Black people, the archive is understood to be a space of absence. Because I feel like there's a whole edited volume that's written largely by historians that are like, there's nothing there. We have got to, I don't know, pick up the dust and imagine how Black people used it. My experience of the archive, though, is like one of bounty, interestingly enough. And maybe it's just my hopeful sensibilities. But I think what is curious to me is that archival libraries, and you know, I have the ones who in mind that have generously funded my research, like the American Antiquarian Society and the Library Company. They have a lot of stuff about Black people, and it goes back pretty far. But I think that also a part of what has maybe been taught sometimes, as well as you know, maybe the archive itself. Its own kind of contested history or histories, I think the assumption is somehow that the absence is the only way to read and understand what's there. And yet there hasn't been enough attention paid to what is there. So like Uber Tanner's letters or Wheatley's letters to Tanner are at the Massachusetts Historical Society. They're in the back of the Penguin edition that you can get at Barnes & Noble's. No S. but no one has talked about them. I mean, I think I don't know if I have already said this story here or elsewhere, but you know, I remember being at a conference and having a colleague ask me, like, where are the letters? Who's got them? I was like, the Penguins got them. But if you're feeling froggy and want to check out the manuscript, go to the Mass Historical. So I think that on the one hand, there is a very real lack. I think there's a way to have a conversation about who controls the archive, who wants to, who is in the position of authority that needs and wants to remember a particular kind of information. And I'm here for that conversation, but I've also just been really wrestling with the fact that there is stuff there, and that stuff is not what folks have an eye to. And I think I've been wondering, like, why not? Like, what is it? You know, is it the archival libraries not marketing right? Is it scholarly assumptions and student assumptions about what is actually in the holdings? I mean, I think that there are all kinds of kind of complicated, you know, who has access to the digital questions as well, depending on your institution. I mean, I found this stuff because I was at graduate school at Johns Hopkins, and Hopkins had Evans' online digital database, and they had a subject header, and it said, Blacks as Authors. I was like, oh, that's clever. Click. And suddenly, a world opens up. So I think that what I've been wrestling with is less what the archive doesn't have and more with, like, why aren't more of us there to know what's there, and also to begin to ask those questions that have us, you know, thinking about pleasure or thinking about what in fact is possible or what is curious or what we haven't yet thought about or conceived of or imagined. I mean, I think your question about the actual material culture has been an interesting one. I was slow to that. I definitely was content to just look at the digitized version, like, oh, okay, I don't need to let's look at it in print. It's already been typed. Bet that works. And it's, I can just print it out, you know, at the school printer. But then, of course, you know, I grew up in my scholarliness and realized that there is another kind of world that opens up. So looking at this last letter and realizing it, there are all these different kinds of dashes, or looking at her handwriting and realizing, like, I had to sit down and imagine what it takes to write with a quill pen and make it look cute all at one and the same time. Like, oh, huh. You know, that does something different than actually looking at my Penguin edition.
I just had a quick comment about the I have not been unmindful.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think it has to be either or. And in fact, it certainly feels like it's kind of saying, sorry, I haven't written. But that I have not been unmindful is establishing this other place outside the letters where their relationship is. And I think it speaks to what you're talking about, the pleasure. The pleasure of their relationship isn't just in the letters, right? It's in the relationship and the mindfulness of that relationship. So I think that that's one of the ways that we're seeing that kind of interiority that's hard to grasp.
And the interiority is there in the letters. You know, it's very much present.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you all.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Tara Bynum, Assistant Professor of English and African American Studies at Hampshire College. Professor Bynum's lecture was titled Dear Sister, Phyllis Wheatley's Pleasures, and was presented by the Boston University Department of English, the American and New England Studies Program, and the African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of English, Joseph Rezek. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.